Once more under the breach, dear friends. Let's fill up the wall with our English dead. And this is Jeff McClure starring in The Personal Wealth Coach today. This last Saturday of 2017. Jake is normally here. Normally I say once more under the breach, dear friend. And he says, else fill up the wall with our English dead. And we go on from there. However, somebody asked him last week if the coast was clear. And he says, I don't know, so I'll go down and check. So he's somewhere down on the Gulf Coast enjoying the warm, balmy weather this New Year's holiday weekend. I asked him if he was going to go swimming, and he said he didn't really intend on it. Why he chose to go down there this particular time, he didn't explain to me, but that's all right. Well, this is Jeff McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. Personal Wealth Coach has got a couple of factors that are, I think are important. One, it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that is has its primary regulator, the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. If you ever want to make a complaint about us, that's where to go. I don't know if they'll listen, but you can certainly make the complaint. The other thing is that I happen to be the principal owner, and Jake is the other owner there, so they're both one and the same in many aspects. But what we give on this radio program is not investment advice. It's educational information, and there's a difference. Anything that we say on here, of course, we've tried to find the best and most accurate information from normally reliable sources. We don't make any guarantees about it or much of anything else. And we also recognize that each individual is an individual. Each portfolio is unique. Each person has their own goals, and what is good for one person might not be good for another. So take that in mind when you hear what I have to say or we have to say on this radio program. Well, this is Saturday, December 30th, 2017. It is the end of a remarkable year in the stock market. And the stock market ended on a interesting note. It ended down for the week. The S&P 500 actually for the week was down 0.36%, which is insignificant, but it's unusual. Unusual because typically we get what's called a Santa Claus rally in the last week of the year, and it has a lot to do with the way people approach investing. It has a lot to do with what's called window dressing and in funds, buying stocks and putting them in there that are when they make their report as of December 31st, this is the stocks we owned in a fund or in an ETF. They look pretty impressive that way. Didn't happen this year. And that's an interesting thing. There's an old saying on Wall Street that if Santa Claus doesn't show up, then the bears will follow. That may or may not ever have been true, and it may not be true this year. There's certainly no indications that right now that next year would be a bear market. It's one of those old things that for better or worse, is kind of passing into oblivion, because in the days when these old saws would appear, these old pieces of wisdom about the market, the vast majority of trading on the market was done by investors who were buying and selling individual stocks. Today, by far, the majority of trading done by regular people, human beings, is in mutual funds and ETFs, and the rest of the next, perhaps the biggest on some days. Is electronic trading. So we're in a different world, and so it's probably not true. Now, one of the things I did read, if you're interested in making market prognostications, which we don't do, I take that back, we do from time to time. We're pretty good at calling bottoms and not so good at calling tops. But the thing to look for is the low point in the Dow in December, which I don't have right here in front of me, but you go back and look at the low close in December, and if in the first 90 days of the new year we go below that low point in December, then things look pretty bad going forward historically. Now, does that mean it's going to happen? No, because again, when these old pieces of wisdom came up about the market, it was a bunch of individuals trading in the market, and that is certainly a minority of the trading that goes on today. And we're in a different world. Now, admittedly, people create the programs that do the trading, and people do the trading in mutual funds, but it's a different set of people. So we'll see. What we can say, and I think it's very important, is that for 2017, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up over 25%. The S&P 500, which we consider to be more representative of the stock market, if we want to talk about the whole market, was up 19.42%. The S&P 500 closed out at 2,673.61. The Dow closed at 24,719.22. There was, and this, to put this in a little perspective, I've been at this now for a long time, 35 years. And when I came on board in 1982 and first began my career as a broker, which I did for 25 years before we dropped the brokerage aspect of our business and became investment advisors, which are a totally different thing, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was below 1,000. And the big, it was a big deal when it crossed over in the fall of 1982, when it crossed over the 1,000 mark. Now, that's not the first time it had done it. It had done it actually twice before, but it never could hold above 1,000. The Dow Jones Industrial Average would hit 1,000 and then sag back down into the 800s and sometimes the 700s. And it had been doing so for a long time. In 1973, it crossed over 1,000, promptly went into a bear market for the rest of 1973 and into the beginning of 1974, it dropped about 50%, the market did, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average with it. And so there was this kind of tradition that had been going on for 10 years that anytime the Dow crossed 1,000, buckle your seatbelts because we're in for a crash. And a lot of people believe that, and that was becoming a stockbroker, so I encountered that a lot from people. And didn't happen, of course. And now we're talking about, in the near future, the Dow at 25,000. It's at 24,719 now at the end of this year. That is an amazing factor, the fact that over a period of my career so far, we've seen the Dow Jones Industrial Average, not counting dividends reinvested, rise from 1,000 to 25,000. And here's the interesting point. Back then, the price-to-earnings ratio, the forward price-to-earnings ratio on the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 was about 18, which is the average. It's still about 18. In other words, the market really has not gone up. As it stands today, the stock market of the United States is at the same price-to-earnings ratio it was in 1982, 1983, which means that it isn't excessively priced. It isn't cheap. Now, there are times it's gone down in the interim to 10. It's gone down to 7. And for those of you who don't understand price-to-earnings ratio, that basically says that the total earnings of the, let's use the S&P 500, the total annual earnings, the profits of the S&P 500, if the market was at 10, would be one-tenth the price. In other words, if the earnings didn't go up, it would take 10 years of those earnings to pay for the stock, the price of the average stock in the S&P 500. What does that mean? It's a good measure of the value of a stock. It's a good measure just as real estate. In real estate, if you're buying commercial real estate, the key for successful long-term purchase of real estate is called the cap rate, the capitalization rate. In other words, if my free cash flow after depreciation and expenses on a piece of real estate is one-tenth the price I paid for it, then I have a cap rate of 10. That's a P/E ratio of 10. And that means that if I don't raise the rents. My expenses don't go up. If everything's static, then over the next 10 years, I'll get my money back for the purchase in profits. And from there going forward, it's pure profit. Now, why does that make sense? If you think about the idea of investing in something and thinking that you won't get a profit for 10 years, probably is not the best position to be in the world. The reality is, in commercial real estate property, rarely do you have 10-year leases. They're generally one-year leases. And after a year, in many cases, you can raise the rent. And with the price-to-earnings ratio of the stock market, again, it's the same thing. Earnings rise, and earnings have been rising, so that when the market was 25% lower, or 20% lower, depending on which index you look at, a year ago, the price-to-earnings ratio, the forward price-to-earnings ratio, which is the important one, the earnings expected for the next year, was about the same as it is today. Which means the stock market really, in a real term, the stock market hasn't risen, earnings have. And that's an important factor. So I need to give out a couple of things. I need to give out the telephone number. I think that's important. The telephone number in here at KTEM is 254-773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. Is the telephone number to call if you'd like to join me in here with any questions or thoughts or comments about anything to do with the economy, the markets, or investing. Those are the areas that I can comment on with a great deal of confidence and professionalism. Please do not call in and ask about anything that has anything to do with professional sports. You missed the last show, obviously, where Ed Laughlin ask a lawyer. So obviously the key thing is to ask a lawyer about something to do with sports. And I don't understand that. Ed's a great guy. He seems to be a darn good attorney. And he also seems to be pretty focused on sports, which I'm not and we're not. So the year-to-date Dow Jones Industrial Average up 19.42. So let's look at a little further out. Let's bring in a little closer. For the month of December, the Standard & Poor's 500 SPX, as it's called, was up 1.19. And for December, 6.12%. As I said earlier, for the year 2017, up 19.42%. So let's look at a little longer-term perspective on that. Well, let's look outside of the traditional. If we look at the U.S. market and we say, man, it did really, really well. However, the MSCI Emerging Markets Index, which basically covers all of the markets that are not in Europe or the United States or Japan, in other words, the non-developed markets, was up 20. The world index was up 24%, and the emerging markets index was up 35.53% for 2017. And frankly, that tells you a lot. It tells you that the emerging markets was the ideal place to be in retrospect, looking back. But had you been in emerging markets, that index, which you can't actually invest in the index. There are some ETFs and there are some index funds that try to track it. And you've been there for the last 5 years. You'd been invested there. Your average annual rate of return would have been 1.8%. And, all of that, 1.8% a year, came as a result of being there this year, this 2017. Whereas, had you been in the S&P 500 for that same time period, your average annual rate of return had been 13.89%. And you say, wow, so obviously U.S. stocks over the last 5 years are the place to be. Well, I don't know. Let me expand this a little further even. You take the New York Stock Exchange Composite, which is the average stock on the New York Stock Exchange, which is a lot of stocks, obviously. The five-year average there is 9%. So when we talk about the market and we talk about investing and we talk about indexes, different indices or indexes measure different things in the market, and there are different areas of the market that they measure. And because one of them is going like gangbusters doesn't necessarily mean that every place else is. And this is one of the keys. If we go back 30 or 40 years, emerging markets constitute the highest return in the market. If we go back 5 years, the highest return of any asset class. If you go back 5 years, it's one of the lowest. And this is where the mystery and I think the science of investing comes in, is nobody has been able to successfully predict when these asset classes are going to shift around and when the various asset classes are going to do very well and when they're going to do very, very poorly. And there have been a lot of people, and I do mean a lot of people over the decades, that have made a sincere effort to say, well, you need to be in this or you need to be in that or you need to be in this other thing over here, and there you'll make a lot of money and here's the time to get out. As a matter of fact, one of the things we've looked at over the years is hedge funds that have attempted to do exactly that, who have attempted to be real winners in many cases during certain aspects of the market, certain times of the market. These funds have done exceptionally well. And hedge funds are different from mutual funds or a lot of other places because they often take a lot more aggressive stance and take a bigger speculative guess and a bigger speculative investment in an area. In many cases, they actually go out and borrow money to multiply the effect. And while they have often turned in truly astonishingly good returns, you don't hear as much about the fact that the best, highest return hedge funds in any given year often, not always, but very often, and I would even say the majority of the headliner hedge funds, within a few years cease to exist. And they cease to exist because they got abysmal returns in consecutive years that erased the gains, and people bailed out. And in many cases, when the people bailed out of the fund, they discovered that even what was on their statement as being the value of the fund really wasn't there, because it was there only until they sold it. One of the amazing things about being a market investor or an investor in anything is you hear the stories, and you see the stories in the newspapers when people get lucky and they hit the right time at the right place doing something extraordinarily aggressive, and it works, and they effectively win the lottery. What you don't hear so much is when that doesn't work. And we've talked about this before, but one of the issues, for example, that's hit the Yale and Harvard endowments, specifically recently the Yale endowment was the one that got knocked between the eyes with a sledgehammer. They've hired a new manager, and he has dropped their value about 25%, their appraised value on the their stated value on their endowment, and he wants to drop it further. And the board of directors there said no, let's not drop it further, let's not be that aggressive, let's just wait and see. And the reason was, There's more to it than this, but one of the main reasons was a big chunk of the Yale endowment, a significant investment there, was in forest land. And this particular forest land was eucalyptus groves in, I think, Brazil. Eucalyptus forests in Brazil. And the demand for eucalyptus wood apparently fell off. And they took a look at their huge eucalyptus forest that they owned, that they had carried on the books at an appraised value. In other words, appraisers in Brazil would go out each year and take a look at this big chunk of forest and say, what is it worth? And they would do their calculations, and they would come back and say, here's how much it's worth. And they'd carry it on the books for that. And that's called an alternative investment, by the way. The problem was, when they went to sell this Brazilian eucalyptus forest at a rather substantial discount to the price they had paid for it, they got no buyers. And that's not the only place this has gone on. One of the things that has been very attractive in the last several years, particularly since the market collapse and or the meltdown of 2008 and 2009, has been something called alternative investments. And we've stayed away from those. We stay away from them because in most cases, alternative investments are not liquid, meaning you can't sell five shares in a million acres of forest land because it just doesn't work that way. And in many cases, it's very difficult to carve off a piece of that forest land or a piece of whatever alternative investment is in a portfolio that is illiquid. It's not something that there's a ready market for, and it's priced every day on an open market, an open bid market. And people are buying and selling interests in it. And because it's not that way, you really don't know what it's worth. But the nice thing about it is you can get an appraiser to come in and say it's worth a little more each year, which makes the portfolio appear to rise in value. The same thing's true, by the way, when you have a fixed annuity or something like that in a portfolio. A fixed deferred annuity, it's worth so many dollars, and they apply so much interest to it in any given year. And you say, well, now if it was worth $100,000, and somebody applied 55% interest to it, it's now worth $500 more dollars. Well, that's really cool. If you applied 5% interest, it's worth $5,000 more if it was $100,000. So I got $105,000 worth of annuity in it. But one of the questions that is really, really important to ask yourself is, if I tried to sell that annuity today, who would I sell it to and what would I get for it? Now, in many cases, the insurance company will buy the annuity back. But in other cases, if they do buy the annuity back, it will be with a 15% discount. So you might have an annuity that you purchased for $100,000, has had 5% over the last couple of 3 years added to it. So now you've got $5,000 of profit that you show in there, unless you decide to sell it. And if you sell it, you might suddenly discover that it's only worth $90,000. Well, that's a pretty big chunk of money. That's a 10% loss instead of a 5% gain. And if that is the case where you have your money, then it's really worth $90,000. And very frankly, you should carry it on your portfolio listing and whatever is $90,000, not $105,000. Because something is only worth what it's worth. It isn't worth what an appraiser or a document says it's worth. It's only worth what it will sell for. And that is one of the most fundamental things to understand in any investment or investment portfolio. The value of something you own for the purposes of investment is only worth what you could sell it for at that moment. That's worth writing down. It's worth considering. It's worth thinking about. If you're invested in a highly liquid position, such as stocks or broadly traded bonds or like government bonds or something, then you can track, at least daily, the value at which that is selling today. Now, that doesn't mean you can sell it for that tomorrow, but at least you have a good idea what it was worth on a given day. If you have something that nobody's selling and nobody's buying, you don't know what it's worth unless there's a contractual obligation. And again, we talk about buying an annuity because it's safe and it's secure. It's neither, by the way. Then you actually, in many cases, have one prime purchase proposal, and that is from the insurance company. Now, does that mean you can't sell the annuity to somebody else? You sure can. And that's one of the more fascinating things that I've discovered over the years in my many years of observing these things. There are what's called secondary markets for annuities. And in many cases, you'll find out that the price on the secondary market, the price that an annuity broker would sell you, would pay you for your annuity, is substantially lower than you might think. And the reason is the insurance company in every state, but then since we're in Texas, we'll talk about Texas law. An insurance company on a fixed annuity, not a variable annuity, but a fixed annuity, has the right to delay paying you up to 6 months. If you say, give me my, I want to sell my annuity back to you, they have the right to wait unless, and there's certain circumstances where they can actually delay it more than 6 months. So that's an issue. And the second issue is, what is the annuity worth if the insurance company goes out of business? And the answer is probably not much. It might be worth what you paid for it after an extended period of time through the state guarantee fund. But state guarantee funds have been noted to fold up unexpectedly if we get economic downturns. So in many cases, what people do is they buy a fixed annuity and they put it in their portfolio as a cushion against a major economic downturn when the stock market and bond markets go down. Well, that's exactly the moment when the insurance company would go down. And why would the insurance company go down? Well, backing that annuity is a portfolio of stocks and bonds, mostly bonds. And if that portfolio doesn't hold up and make a profit, and that's exactly the circumstances you bought this for when things are not profitable. And a lot of people say, I want money rather than just a statement in a piece of paper, then the insurance company would have to start liquidating portfolios that are trading at a loss, and at some point they will hit their reserve limits. And once they hit their reserve limits, that's when they declare that they don't have enough reserves and the state seizes them, and you just have to stand in line behind the other creditors. They effectively are in receivership or bankruptcy at that point. In some cases, the manager at the state level attempts to turn them around and get them into a recovery condition. In some cases, they just shut them down and give you whatever's left over. For example, a few years ago, there was a insurance company, and I'm trying to remember the name of it right now, Executive Life, that had been in receivership under management by various states, different pieces of it, for decades. And they finally said, no, we can't turn this thing around. And they said, okay, all of the people who had annuities at Executive Life, congratulations, you get back 30 cents on the dollar. And that was it. And the people who owned the annuities from the then highly rated Executive Life of Executive Life of California or Executive Life of New York or wherever it was, got back for every dollar that they had put in 20 years ago, they got back 30 cents. Now, when you factor in inflation, it really boiled down to about 15 cents. So that wasn't a good thing, and we kind of tend to say, oh, well, that can't happen because I've not heard of it happening, and there's no big media push on it. Well, what happened back in the past to cause that? Why did that life insurance company suddenly go under many, many years ago? It's actually more than 20 years ago now that I think about it. It's more like 30. What happened was interest rates started up. And here in the United States, we have had 30-plus years of falling interest rates. And in a falling interest rate environment, if you buy a longer-term, high-yielding bond, and the bond doesn't go out of business, the company that issued the bond doesn't go bankrupt, and for instance, if you buy treasury bonds, or if you buy AAA-rated, very, very secure bonds from one of the big companies, and interest rates fall over the succeeding years, and the company has not put themselves in a position where they can buy the bond back and reissue it to you at a lower interest rate, then those bonds become worth more and more and more. For example, bonds maturing 20 years in the future right now that are trading on various bond exchanges. Actually, there's not a true bond exchange, but are reported in the Wall Street Journal, are paying, have prices as high as 126, and which means if you bought a $1,000 bond on the market today through a broker, you would pay $1,260 for a bond that will mature at $1,000 in, let's say, 20 years. Why would you do that? Well, because that bond has a 6 or 7% coupon, so it's going to pay you $60 or $70 a year on the $1,000 face value. But obviously you didn't pay $1,000 for it. The original owner paid $1,000 for it, and they then sold it at a gain, and let's use this, let's say they sold it at $125. They had a $250 gain when they sold it. You paid, because of fees and exchanges and spreads and things like that, you paid, and you went to buy it on the market, and you paid $1,260 for the same bond. Well, it's still got a 6 or 7% what's called coupon, and it looks like you're getting a 6 or 7% rate on the $1,000 face of the thing. But if you think about it for a minute, you're going to lose $260. So if you're getting $60 a year, it's going to take you quite a while to recover that $260 to break even. And you're going to reach the point, and then after that, inflation will eat into the value of the bond. So when you finally settle out at the end, there's something called yield to maturity. And the yield maturity on those same bonds is 2 to 3%. So if you held the bond to maturity and you very carefully kept all the interest and you socked it away in a savings account, at the end of 20 years, you would have roughly the same amount of money that you paid for the bond, except that inflation, even at low inflation rates, would have eaten that value down significantly over 20 to 30 years, over 20 years from now. So you'd actually have less money. Now, why would you do that? Well, this is something that's been going on in treasuries for some time, and that is people are willing to lose a certain amount of money in a treasury position to avoid losing a lot of money in other places. Well, here's the interesting thing. There just aren't any 20-year periods in the stock market, in the history of that market, where you would have lost money. There just aren't any. There are precious few 10-year periods when you would have lost money, considering dividends reinvested. So out at about 10, somewhere between 10, 15 years, if we go back through the history of when we've had stock markets in the United States, and we look at the stock market as a whole, not individual stocks within it, we discover that we run out of any worst-case scenario, including 1929, when you actually would have had less money 15 years later than you put in. So there's a time horizon on the stock market. And it's actually, given the dividends, reinvestments, and so on, and given the fact that we have some safeguards in the economy today that we didn't have in the past, the probability of losing money in a broad-based market investment, and by that I mean you basically purchase one share of everything in the stock market and keep updating that, which is what an index does, the probability of losing money over a 10-year period becomes vanishingly close to zero. So for that reason, we take a look at when we're looking down the road and saying, is the market overpriced, or is the market underpriced? And we look at the yield on a 10-year treasury bond, which is about 2.4% right now. And we look at the earnings, the profitability yield, the earnings yield on the S&P 500, which is considerably higher, almost twice that. And we realize that the market's not overpriced, because the chances of losing your dollar principal, not counting, we're not worried about inflation at the moment, but the probabilities of putting $1,000 into the market and losing money over the next 10 years is the same as putting your money in your investment into a treasury bond or treasury note for 10 years and then getting your money back at 10 years. The risk is effectively zero between the two. The value at any given moment could go up or down depending on a whole lot of things in both of those. So when the market has a higher yield than a treasury bond or 10-year treasury note, then the market is not overpriced, it's underpriced. And it's still somewhat underpriced. And that's an important thing to remember as we move forward into 2018, as we come through this the transition that we've done in 2017. We came out of a recovery and moved into an expansion in 2017. And we'll talk about that a little more, what that means to you strategically, what that means to you long-term in the market, what that means to us in the economy. And hopefully, over the next hour and 20 minutes or so, we'll get into even more detail about where we are in history. But we're going to play some commercials right now, presuming that I can figure out how to get the get the commercials to play. And I will be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. And Lord willing, we'll be back in a few minutes after these commercials. And once again, you're listening to Jeff McClure and the Personal Wealth Coach. Jake is out of town down at the coast doing whatever he does on the coast when he goes out of town for the coast. And the telephone number in here remains 773-1400. Area code, of course, is 254. And we're talking about where the stock market is at the end of 2017. One of the things that I think generally the people who have a lot of experience with markets are saying, and I agree, is the kind of kick that we have seen in the market in 2017 is extremely unlikely to be repeated in 2018. We started 2017, coming out of 2016, in a somewhat depressed market. We'd had fears of China's collapse. We had fears of oil prices somehow creating some kind of a disaster. There was a lot of fear. And there was a lot of skepticism. We'd come through a presidential election where there was no incumbent running for office, which means that both the Republicans and the Democrats were saying vile things about the economy and how they needed to fix it. We had a rebound at the end, about this time last year, and we had a rebound. It's called a relief rally. Not necessarily because President Trump was elected, but simply because we finally got rid of the negative rhetoric. The rebound rally kind of fell off after a little bit. There was a tremendous amount of optimism and hope that instantly President Trump would somehow do some, and the Republicans who had taken control of both houses in Congress would somehow do something magical and cause wonderful things to happen, and that kind of faded away. But over the year, even though legislatively very little happened, what didn't happen was just as important. And what didn't happen was that we didn't get increasingly burdensome regulations in business. That helped. Obviously, the Tax Act that passed at the end of the year was a boon for the market. But if you actually track the market behavior during the time that the Tax Act was being debated, during periods when it was pretty likely, it appeared pretty likely, we were going to get tax cuts for corporations and in the economy, we got a little market bump upward, and then when it looked like maybe it wasn't going to work, we got a little market move downward, but we're talking about a percent or two at most. So, very frankly, I don't think that the tax reform, and it really wasn't tax reform, the tax cuts have a great deal to do with the pricing that's in the stock market today. As a matter of fact, the forward earnings estimates that we've seen from corporations, which is the subject, which is the basis upon which market prices work, have not included the positives of the tax cut. Why? Well, because the tax bill, they can't do that until the tax bill is signed. Well, now it's been signed. So sometime in January or February, we start getting conference calls from corporations that say, here's what our earnings, we expect our earnings to be in the during the first quarter and for the fourth quarter. At that point, they will begin to discuss the effect that the new tax law has on their company's earnings. And generally speaking, that's going to be a positive. There's certainly exceptions to that, and the major bank, Goldman Sachs, for example, took a pretty substantial write-off that they've announced already for the first quarter because they're going to be hit with a significant tax on their overseas holdings, a significant income tax, and they're actually going to have a loss probably for the quarter booked on their books. Because of the change in the tax law. They actually had their taxes go up on a one-time basis. In the longer term, it's probably positive for all the major corporations and any business in the United States. I know that in our small business, we've done a quick and dirty tax estimation and concluded that what we got was a 28% tax cut. I don't think if you're not a business owner that you're going to get a tax cut at that level. We were pleasantly surprised, and any business owners out there should be celebrating the new year and very, very happy about this very impressive, very profound tax cut that we got from Congress. Now, in the longer term, that very tax cut might be problematic, and it might be problematic in that nobody, even if we use the most optimistic estimates based on the Republican-controlled committees in the House and in the Senate that put this tax bill together, the very most optimistic and rosy and delightful estimates of future returns from the tax cuts, we're still going to wind up with $1 trillion more debt in 10 years than we have today. Than we would have if we kept with the same tax law. Now, so it's not going to pay for itself. And the tax law, in order to hold the estimated increase in debt using more generally accepted principles to $1.5 trillion, a lot of the personal tax cuts that you're going to see will disappear in 2025 to 2027. Well, they'll all be gone by 2027. A lot of them will disappear in 2025. 5 to 7 years from now is when those tax cuts will disappear and your taxes will start back up again unless Congress takes action. Can Congress take action at that point to extend the tax cut? Not without raising taxes someplace else or without repealing some of the laws that Congress depends on. So, that the system that we have, the fiscal system in the United States today depends on. Some of those laws say you can't run huge deficits and increasing deficits forever. They put some limits on that. That was back when Newt Gingrich was in. We have a Balanced Budget Act. We have several of those acts that are out there. It's called a Pay-Go Act. Matter of fact, Congress has had to act. Because of increasing the deficit consciously, Congress has had to pass a special bill or put an amendment on a bill, and they've done a stopgap, and hopefully sometime in January they'll finish that one off, to keep Medicare from automatically being cut because they passed a bill increasing the deficit by that much. And they basically are saying, well, this is an exception to the Balanced Budget Act that we passed back when, because we were so much against deficits at that point. So the piper will need to be paid. It'll be down the road, but the piper will need to be paid. Speaking of paying the piper, we've got some more commercials that we have to run. And at that point, presuming I can figure out again how to do this, we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. Jake is out of town, down at the coast, enjoying the balmy, warm weather, and I'm sure they're having a grand time swimming in the Gulf of Mexico in this delightful weather that we're having right here, or whatever they're doing down there. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. We only have about 4 minutes left in this hour. We have a second hour coming up. And we've been talking about the markets in general, the five-year return to the market, and some of the things that I believe are pretty important to understand when we go to build a portfolio for the coming year. From the economic point of view, Bloomberg conducted a survey recently, and they basically went through several thousand companies that are listed on various exchanges in the United States, publicly traded companies. And they asked them what they plan to do with their taxed windfall, the tax rate that they are going to pay dropped from a maximum of about 35% to a maximum of 21%. Many of them have lost some deductions, so they're not going to get the full break that you would expect out of that because many of them were already paying 20%. But they're across the board, there's going to be a lot of money appearing in the coffers of and in the earnings statements of corporations, publicly traded corporations in the United States. That's one of those things that is a reality. There's a second relatively huge chunk of money, trillions of dollars, that's going to come in from overseas because companies have been taxed in the United States on that money they hold overseas. Next year, they're going to pay taxes on that. And it won't cost them. Once they pay the taxes, it doesn't cost them anything to bring it home. And in many cases, they're going to bring it home. And so the two questions that are out there is these are two different sources of funds. And people are and corporations and executives are going to receive these funds. And there's lots of things they can do with that money. And they're going to do something with that money. Well, the first thought was stock buybacks. That's a very common way that corporations run up the prices in their stocks, and apparently at least a significant portion of the money that's coming home from overseas is going to be used for stock buybacks. So that's going to raise the price of stocks in some companies, which of course raises the value of the holdings of the executives and gives them more money, and it's pretty cool from their perspective. The second thing they're going to do, the major corporations with the money coming home, the number two priority is mergers and acquisitions. That means they're going to go out and buy other companies with it, which again tends to run the price of stocks up. So those are two big plus things. Their number three with the money coming home was to invest in plants and equipment. And in many cases, that means buying robotics. Now, if you go to the second question, the one that was asked by Bloomberg, which is what are you going to do with your tax benefits that are coming in this year, this in 2018, that you didn't have last year? And the answer is they're going to primarily invest in expanding plants and equipment, which is pretty fascinating. We'll talk about that more next hour because if you expand a company, you have to have some means of making the product or the service that the company sells. And the fact is that we're running out of people to hire. We are at effective full employment now, which means that people are having trouble hiring, and they're unwilling and unable to raise wages. So what are they going to do with it? We'll talk about that next hour. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. My name is Jeff McClure. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have a voicemail on the weekend at either 254-947-1111, or alternatively, you have the voicemail. We also have voicemail at a local telephone number. It's 947-1111. You're certainly welcome to give us a